for in these two chapters is, first of all, the throne of God, God's presence among them. And then second, the condition that was leading to this judgment. Why was God going to judge the people? Then there was to be the destruction of the city. It would be burned. It would be destroyed. But the hope found in the midst of this gloom and this and all of that was the fact that there would be a remnant that God would spare. He's going to spare a remnant. Another thing, you remember when we began the book of Ezekiel, we read the 24th chapter of Jeremiah. And I think that picture ought to be kept before us. Jeremiah saw two baskets of figs in his vision. One of them were very good figs. The other were rotten and very bad. They were terrible. Now, those terrible ones represented the people that were to remain in Jerusalem. These would not be fit to live. They'd be destroyed. Out of those were carried away into Babylon in 597. Out of that group of about 10,000, God would preserve a remnant through whom he would bring back a group to Jerusalem. Now, they would be the ones that would be worth something to him. Now, let's keep that in mind, because I think that vision is really a kind of a summary of what God is doing with the good people and the bad people among them. Now, the people in Jerusalem were looking upon these that were carried away into captivity as being not among them anymore, not fit to be with them. God was showing respect for these that were left there. And these others were disdained by the Jews in Jerusalem. And our lesson today, God is pointing out in this vision that the ones that he's going to save will be out of a remnant that's carried away, and those in Jerusalem will be destroyed with a city there. Some would be scattered, some would be slain with a sword, some destroyed with pestilence, some brought into captivity. Now, Ezekiel's purpose is out of these were carried away with him to preserve a remnant with faith in God, to preserve their faith. Now, this is his task, and that's what he's doing all the way through. All right, let me turn now to let me just summarize what was in the 8th and 9th chapter briefly. In the 8th chapter, you had this vision of four different groups. That was that altar of jealousy to the north of the court there, which I think symbolized their worship of the Ashtaroth, or the female goddess concept. That seems to be what that represented. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody did all of these things, but these are the basic things among the people. Now, I think that the prophet is describing, actually, what is in their hearts, the heart condition there. Now, then second, he dug through the wall, and there was a door, opened the door and went in. There on the wall, there were all manner of figures drawn there, and the 70 elders were worshiping them. That suggests, again, the idolatry among the men of the community, of the group there. And it's not something literal, but it simply symbolizes their idolatrous attitude. Then from there, he saw the women weeping because of Tammuz, who was the sun god of the Assyrians. And they were worshiping. Now, this was a nature god that in the summertime, when it got brown and everything died down, no rain, well, that symbolized the dying, and then in the spring, the resurrection. It was a nature god, and they were worshiping this god. Then from there, he saw the 25 men with their backs to the temple of God, worshiping the sun. Right? Now, this was a Babylonian sun god that you're worshiping here. The other one is Babylonian too, but this is festive. But at any rate, both from that country, the Tammuz. Now, here, this represented the priesthood, and that they were turning away from God to this god of the Babylonians, the sun god, which seemed to have been stronger than their god. Now, these are the four things he saw. Then he saw in the 9th chapter, these six men with a sword, one with an inkhorn, he was to mark those that were concerned about the situation. All right. So this then is the condition here now. Here's what they said in this 9th chapter and about verse 9. He said, they said, therefore, they say, Jehovah hath forsaken the land, and Jehovah seeth not. And they decided that God had forsaken them, didn't see what was going on, so they turned to these other gods. Now in chapter 10, then I looked, and behold, in the firmament that was over the head of the cherubim, there appeared above them, as it were, a sapphire stone, as the appearance of the likeness of a throne. And he spake unto the man clothed in linen, and said, Go in between the whirling wheels, even under the cherub, and fill both thy hands with coals of fire from between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city. Let me make this observation also. Now, the Jews' concept was that Jehovah dwelt in their midst between the cherubim over the altar, over the lid of the Ark of the Covenant there, and that he dwelt in Jerusalem. Now, this was the thing that they put their trust in, because God had been among them. His glory appeared between the cherubim that covered the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant there. So therefore, they trusted that they were safe because of that. Now, what the main lesson we're learning in this lesson today is that Jehovah is leaving that particular position. He's leaving the temple and going over to the little hill to the east there, Mount of Olives. And when he left the temple, all the temple was just a shell. Not anything but just a building of stones and whatever made it up. Unless God was there. Now this lesson today is, in a vision, he sees God leaving the temple, departing and leaving it a shell to be destroyed. And when this hand reaching in and getting the fire indicates the scattering of fire over the city, the burning of the city, because Jehovah has left it. Now this is what I'm not going to try to explain all of these different symbols. I don't understand all of them, all these wheels and all that. What this symbolizes, I know what it symbolizes. Symbolizes the chariot throne of Jehovah. That God can be in Babylon among the cherubim as well as in Jerusalem. That he's not limited to one particular place. And also in a vision. Remember, we're not limited to time or space in a vision. That is, here this thing can happen over a period of years that he sees, but he sees it in this vision while the elders are still sitting before him. All of this takes place. But we move on. Now he said, you take coals of fire there. Now the cherubim stood on the right side of the house when the man went in and the cloud filled the inner court. Now the point is here that this judgment is from God. It's from God, but through the instrumentality of man. Nebuchadnezzar is going to be the one and his army that destroys the city. So it's a judgment of God executed by and through man. And the glory of Jehovah mounted up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house. And the house was filled with the cloud and the court was full of the brightness of Jehovah's glory. Now let me notice back here in the 8th chapter and verse 4. Now when he's in his vision here, he sees here in verse 4, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, according to the appearance that I saw in the plain. Now, that vision of chapter 1 that we dealt with in our first lesson, where he saw this chariot, throne of God. Now then he sees it again here in this 8th chapter, and now then in the 9th chapter in verse 3. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon it was, to the threshold of the house, and he called the man, clothed in linen, and so on. Now notice here's a gradual departure from within the Holy of Holies. Now then, you see the glory now as it's here on the threshold of the building. What he's pointing out is the departure of the glory of Jehovah from the temple. And it'll be nothing but a shell. All right, now here in verse 4 of the 10th chapter, and the glory of Jehovah mounted up in the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house. And the house was filled with the cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of Jehovah's glory. So now then here you see him here over the threshold, and here the court is filled with this glory, the brightness of it. Now remember, this is a vision now. This is what he sees in vision. What we're going to try to do is to get the lesson that God is teaching his people. Now notice further, and the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard even unto the outer court as the voice of God Almighty when he speaketh. That is the pouring of these winds and the wings and the wheels and all. I don't attempt to try to explain any significance to these. I'm sure there was. But the lesson I want us to get is what God is trying to teach the people. I don't spend a lot of time in speculating on something that I don't understand and I don't think people know for sure what it means. So no need to do that. But let's get what he's trying to teach them. Now move on further. And it came to pass when he commanded the man clothed in a linen, saying, take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim, that he went in and stood beside a wheel. And the cherub stretched forth his hand from between the cherubim and under the fire that was between the cherubim, and took thereof and put it into the hands of him that was clothed in linen, who took it and went out. Right, so here you have now, just why it was handed this man in linen, who was the one that marked them. That indicates, I think, an angel of Jehovah, a messenger of God, both of them do. But now notice that it's going to be done by a man. And there appeared in the cherubim the form of a man's hand under their wings. Now, what's the significance of that? To me, and I think this is correct, the idea is, now here are these, are the cherubim acting for Jehovah, living creatures. They're Jehovah's messengers, indicating that this judgment is from God. But here the hands of a man that takes the coal and burns the city. That I think symbolizes the use of God, of man as instrumentality through which God is going to do the destruction. And that's where it happened at any rate. You never could imagine his army to burn the city. So what he's seeing is, and wants to impress upon the people, is this fact, that the destruction of your temple and city is a judgment from God. That when God could no longer remain among the people and remove his presence or glory from them, then the city was left fit only for destruction. And I looked, and behold, four wheels beside the cherubim, one wheel beside one cherub, and another wheel beside another cherub. And the appearance of the wheels was like unto a beryl, that is, a stone of Tarshish, whatever color that may be. And as for their appearance, they four had the likeness, as if a wheel had been within a wheel. Well, I had that back the first year, remember? The idea was this, here's a wheel, and here's a wheel. Could go this way, or this way, or this way, or this way, without turning. Now, that could only be in a vision. You couldn't have a literal machine like that, a chariot like that, but you've got to have an axle between them. But in the vision, you can have this. But of course, here's, it indicates the fact that they go their several directions without turning. That was pointed out in chapter 1. You mentioned that. So they can go backwards or forward or this way or that way without any shadow of turning, as James said. That God without shadow of turning there. Right? And so God handles that in that way. Right? Now verse 12 here. And follow it. And they turn. No, I want to read 11. When they went in their four directions. They turned not as they went, but to the place where the head looked, they followed it. They turned not as they went. Well, that's almost, Brother Williams was telling me about a man in the congregation. I believe that this war here, Ezekiel is foretelling this war here, and these airplanes and all that. Well, it sounds pretty good, Brother Williams. Here they've got these airplanes now. Watch that way the man looks, that's the way the gun shoots. He'd be fine looking over yonder. So maybe the old boy got him a point. I'm just kidding. He hasn't got a point at all, because we know that. But this is pretty good grounds for speculation anyway, isn't it? You look at these modern airplanes. Right? And whichever way the fellow looked, that's where the chariot went. Yeah. And their whole body and their backs and their hands and their wings and the wheels were full of eyes round about, even the wheels that they four had. That indicates that God, I think it indicates that God's constant vigilance and watch over all things. He sees everything. And everything that he uses is in his plan here to carry it out, and that which he sees to be done. As for the wheels, they were called in my hearing the whirling wheels. And every one had their faces. The first face was the face of the cherub. Now, in the other, in chapter 1, it was the face of an ox. Now, just why? Change here from ox to cherub. I don't know. I read several speculations of it. One is that he was toward the north, and this was toward the east, and that was the side of the ox. So he just used the word cherub to describe it all. I don't know if that's so or not. I don't know why. But at any rate, the cherub stood for the whole being here, the living creature here, and this side is spoken of as a cherub. The second face is the face of a man. The third, the face of a lion. The fourth, the face of an eagle. That may indicate service and intelligence and strength, speed. Some think that. Some think it simply indicates other aspects of the natural world. I don't know. These are things that we don't really know. And the cherubim mounted up. This is the living creature that I saw by the river Kibar. It's the same thing that he saw there by the river Kibar in chapter 1. So it's simply he's impressing the fact that it was God back there whose glory he saw. Now he sees the God of glory in action. Now here's what he is doing now. And when the cherubim went, the wheels went beside them. And when the cherubim lifted up their wings to mount up from the earth, the wheels also turned not from beside them. In other words, it's a unit. It's a whole thing, God's throne here, and the chariot that represents it, His glory and His presence among them, is a unit. All things work together in harmony with, as God directs it. When they stood, these stood, and when they mounted up, these mounted up with them, for the spirit of the living creature was in them. In other words, here's the spirit of this living creature that's in these wheels and the whole chariot here. So, without trying to speculate, we can simply say that it's in the vision, it is a symbol of the throne of God. In other words, the presence of God, the glory of God. God can be anywhere. He's not limited to Jerusalem. And wherever He is needed, there He is. And so it simply symbolizes one spirit that motivates and dominates God in His work. Now this verse 18, and the glory of Jehovah went forth from over the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubim. Now then here it rises up here now, it leaves the threshold, comes on up now, and it's over. So it's a gradual departure. He's leaving now, but he wants them to see the whole thing. And the cherubim lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight when they went forth, and the wheels beside them, and they stood at the door of the east gate of Jehovah's house, and the glory of the God of Israel was over them above. Now he proceeded on from the temple now, over the court, now into the east gate. And remember that Jesus' idea of God with four wings, and the likeness of the hands of a man was under their wings. And as for the likeness of their faces, they were the faces which I saw by the river Kibar, their appearances and themselves, they went everyone straight forward. So whether it's that way or this way or this way or this way, go straight forward. In other words, there's a definite objective, and they go straight to that objective, whatever it is. Right? Now, what's the point in all this? I think the point in this 10th chapter is that Jehovah is now leaving the temple. He's leaving the temple. The city will be destroyed. It will be destroyed by fire through the instrumentality of man. Man's hand scatters the fire over the city and burns. So this now would, one might say, if Nebuchadnezzar learned of this vision, all of this, and he was the man, he would not persecute these people because his prophecy says he's going to destroy the city. I don't know whether he knew anything about it or that. I'm just suggesting that. But at any rate, this is where we're now. And the 11th chapter. Now here we find the final departure of Jehovah from them. But first of all, here is the evil rulers here and the rebuke to them. Now moreover, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me under the east gate of Jehovah's house, which looked eastward. Now remember, he's in Jerusalem. And here in Jerusalem, he's looking at it from one point of view. Come out on there. Come out on there. Good to see you again. We're in the 11th chapter. I missed about half of it. All right, now notice now, he's lifted up by the Spirit and moved to the east gate of Jehovah's house, which looked eastward. And behold, at the door of the gate, 25 men, and I saw in the midst of them Jezaniah, the son of Azur, and Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah, princes of the people. Now these 25, if there's any relationship between these 25 and the 25 that we had back in chapter 8, there were 25 with their backs to the temple there and looking to the sun and worshiping there. If they're the same, I don't know it. I doubt it. I really don't think they are. But some think they are. I've read one man who thought that they were the same, and others think they are not, and really, so that we just don't know whether they're the same or not. It doesn't matter. It's a different lesson that we're learning. Now, here are these men. Here we're not trying to, say, deal with them specifically, but now notice what they do, what God says. And he said unto me, Son of man, these are the men that devise iniquity and that give a wicked counsel in this city. That's saved. And here's a passage of scripture. I couldn't find any commentator that really knew exactly how to translate this. The translation is very difficult. That say, the time is not near to build houses. This city is the cauldron, and we are the flesh. Very difficult. But the point I think we can get is this, that men were given wicked counsel. Some were saying that this refers to the people who don't build houses because you're coming back. There was one fellow in Jerusalem that prophesied that. sent word over to Babylon, don't build houses because you're coming, you're going to come home within 2 years. But then God rebuked that by Jeremiah, rebuked that prophet for that particular thing. But now look at the ultimate reading of this, which is difficult. Is not the time near to build houses? And maybe that's a better translation, they say. Is not the time near to build houses? This city is the cauldron, and we are the flesh. And that makes more sense, the alternate reading does to me, than the other that. The idea is this. Go ahead and build houses, because as a cauldron here, the pot protects the meat from the fire. So we are the people in the city, and we're protected by the city of Jerusalem here to build houses. Others think that it means, instead of building houses, don't build houses, but let's strengthen the walls of the city to resist whatever may come, for God is in our presence. So just what is the exact meaning of that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But at any rate, I get this point. I know this point is correct. The idea was that here as a cauldron protects the meat from the fire, then we're going to be protected by the city. The city will protect us. Now God's going to go on to show them that no, they will be destroyed, and the ones that God's going to protect are those in Babylon whom they disdain. They disdain them. They've cut them off. Instead of being sympathetic toward them, they're saying that they were the ruble, the trash here, and so God took them away. We're the best ones because we were left, don't you see? Well, it was just the opposite. He carried away 10,000 of the smiths and the artisans, the best of Jerusalem there in that area, and left the scum there. And they were the ones God pointed out, according to Jeremiah, that 24th chapter. They were the rotten pigs, not fit for anything, would be destroyed. So you see, the idea was completely reversed to what the truth was there. The reverse to that. Right, so the point is then, say the time is near, we're the cauldron. Therefore prophesy against them, prophesy, O son of man. So here now is what prophecy that comes out of that, which I think the idea was, that we're protected here, so if the alternate reading is correct, we're in build houses, or if it don't build houses, there was a letter sent, it may be talking to them. In other words, men do not know. We do not know for sure what he's talking about. Just how to fix that. All right? And so instead of building houses, maybe they should have been preparing for the siege, and maybe they were. Now, and the Spirit of Jehovah fell upon me, and he said to me, speak. Thus saith Jehovah, thus have ye said, O house of Israel, for I know the things that come into your mind. And God knows what they're saying, and what they're taught, how they're feeling there. They're feeling secure in the fact that the temple is there. God's been in their midst between the cherubim over the mercy seat, and now that's going to protect us. But now he's showing here that God's withdrawing his presence in that chapter 10. God's withdrawing his presence from among them, and so instead of this cauldron being a protection, it's going to be the place where they're cooked or destroyed, burned. And you have multiplied your slain in this city, and you have filled the streets thereof with the slain. That is the murder that took place there, or it may be that through your idolatry, you have slain the people religiously, so far as God is concerned. Because remember now in chapter 8, you have there those four visions that describe the different forms of idolatry that characterize them. And so now then, that slays people religiously. So now whether he's talking about, you have slain them spiritually by your idolatry, or your idolatry has led you to disregard God's law, and you've slain one another as a result of that. Either idea or both of them may be correct. Idolatry may lead people away from God, slays them spiritually, and then that will lead them to slay one another physically. No regard for God. You get the idea either way there. All right? Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, your slain, whom you have laid in the midst of it, that is the city, they are the flesh, and the city is the cauldron. All right, now that's reversed to what they were saying. We are the people, and this is the cauldron, the city of the cauldron. God said, no, you're slain, since you've slain yourself spiritually and otherwise, then you'll be the people, and the cauldron will be that in which you're cooked. So it'll be the opposite of what you had thought. But you should be brought forth out of the midst of it. And there will be other footnotes said another way, I will bring you out. He's going to bring some out, but some are going to be destroyed. You have feared the sword, and I will bring the sword upon you, saith the Lord Jehovah. So you see, in this city now, with the idea here's a cauldron in which the meat is cooked. Now then, you have feared the sword, I'm going to slay you by the sword. that which you have feared is coming upon you. Instead of fearing me, you have feared the sword of either Syrian, and you've turned to idolatry for protection. I'll bring you out to the sword. So actually the figure is, if you be destroyed in the city or brought out of the city and destroyed, in other words, the city will not protect you. This is the point there. And I will bring you forth out of the midst thereof and deliver you in the hands of strangers, and will execute judgments among you. So here's a judgment coming among the people. So in the 8th chapter, there were the 4 different kinds of idolatry described. The 9th chapter, the marking of those that were concerned and the destruction of the others. In the 10th chapter, the gradual withdrawing of God from the temple and from the Holy of Holies there and leaving the city, which will leave the shadow. Now then, as a result of all of that, here is the destruction of it. In this 11th chapter here, here as a cauldron in which the meat is cooked, so you are going to be destroyed. It will not protect you, but rather be the means of your destruction. I'll bring you out to the sword and judge you and destroy you according to your judgments. This is the picture he's trying to get across. And this is what I want us to see. You shall fall by the sword. I will judge you in the border of Israel, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. Now, that's probably at Riblah up to the north there. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't seem to have come any farther south than there. Send an army down to destroy the city. At any rate, that's where Zedekiah was brought. Zedekiah was brought to Riblah, where Nebuchadnezzar there slew his sons in his presence so he could see it, then put his eyes out, blinded and carried him into captivity. And the purpose of that was that he slew the sons, put his eyes out, the memory of the last thing he saw would be that of his sons being slain in, before him. That was because of his weakness and his idolatry. And if King Zedekiah had listened to Jeremiah, who told him to go ahead and, sit and yield to Nebuchadnezzar, it would only be 70 years. Twice he said it would be 70 years, and then God would deliver you. But no, he wouldn't listen to him. And so not listening to him, well, he brought about his own destruction out of his city. And so then he moves on, and the flesh in the midst of, I will judge you in the border of Israel, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. For you have not walked in my statutes, neither have you executed my ordinances, but you have done after the ordinances of the nations that are round about you. In other words, you have acted now as these nations, these idolatrous nations, you've accepted their deities and acted like them. Now, you're going to pay the same price. What's the lesson in that? I think the lesson is, class, that when God's people act like the world, they become as the world unto him. So when Israel became and acted like a heathen nation, then they became unto God as a heathen nation, as not my people. That's what Hosea said. You're not my people. Lo Ammi, not my people. Lo Ruhamah, without a father's mercy there. Right? So here, when they act like that, then in the New Testament, Paul used that statement, not my people, with reference to the Gentiles. Peter used the same passage with reference to the Jews, not my people. So in other words, here the Gentiles rejected God. They're not God's people. Here are those who were his people, but reject him. They are no longer his people. So what's the basis then of people being God's people? It's not the fact that God has chosen them, but the fact that having been chosen, they have a responsibility there. When they fail to live up to it, they're no longer his people. There's a spiritual relationship there that determines that matter. All right. Moving on over now to the verse 13. And it came to pass when I prophesied that Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah, died. Then fell I down upon my face and cried with a loud voice and said, Our Lord Jehovah, wilt thou make a full end of the remnant of Israel? Now, Pelatiah didn't die because of what anything in Ezekiel said here. And whether Ezekiel knew that at the moment or not, I persuade he did. I learned it later and put it in his book. It doesn't matter. But in this vision, I remember this is a vision. What did he see? In this vision, he sees Pelatiah, as he's learning these things are being revealed to him, he sees Pelatiah dying at that time. And so he saw this in his vision there. So Pelatiah died at that very moment, and Pelatiah was one that when one of those prophets told him what to do back there, contrary to what God was doing. You know, there were several prophets there in Jerusalem that were saying, send word over to Babylon that people don't build houses, because within 2 years you're going to come back home. You'll be home within 2 years. But Jeremiah said, well now, if that's true, then you're a true prophet. But when he dropped dead, within 2 months after Jeremiah had a conversation with him, then that proved that he was a false prophet and Jeremiah was a true prophet. The test of a man's prophesying, whether it comes to pass or not. And so here then, Pelatiah died at that particular time. Now, I know this is the second time now that the prophet cried out. Back in 9 and verse 8, you remember, he said, Bathsheba, and it came to pass while they were smiting, and I was left. That is in a vision now. I fell upon my face and cried and said, Ah, Lord Jehovah, wilt thou destroy all the residue of Israel in thy pouring out of thy wrath upon Jerusalem? For he prays for it. Remember, Jeremiah prayed for it. 3 times God told him, don't pray for this people. And then God made up his mind what he's going to do. And he was to pray after that what he's going to do. Now here again, you see, he prays again. Then I fell down and said, praise and cry to our Lord Jehovah, wilt thou make a full end of the remnant of Israel? Now God's going to move on to tell him that there will always be a remnant. I will spell. Jeremiah asked the question here. Make a full end of Israel. Right, so he's deeply concerned for his people. Deeply concerned. And they came unto me saying, Son of man, thy brethren, even thy brethren, the men of thy kindred, that is the men of thy redemption, near his kin, who redeem an individual, thy kindred and all the house of Israel, all of them are they unto whom the inhabitants of Jehovah, unto us is the land given for possession. Now that's looking for those Jews who've been carried away. What you get out of the land belongs to us. So here they're looking down with a sense of despite upon their brethren who've been carried away in captivity. Instead of being sympathetic toward them and concerned about them, they're saying, well, he carried them away. They don't have any possession with us. The land now belongs to us. In other words, we're going to possess it, even for possession. Therefore, say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, whereas I have removed them, as the one he was talking about up here in this verse, their kindred here, who carried away, they have the possession. I have removed them far off among the nations. And whereas I have scattered them among the countries, yet will I be to them a sanctuary for a little while in the country where they are come. Now, it's these that are carried, that fulfilled, you see, Jeremiah's prophecy, chapter 24. And here, out of the good figs, one carried into captivity, God's going to redeem his remnant. All right, now God said, I've carried them away. Now, then they're going to be my people. Now, you who are saying, the city is our protection. And these others he's taken away from here. Possession is ours. They look down upon them. Now God is saying, no, you've got it all backwards. You're going to be the meat in the cauldron there. It's going to be burning there. You're going to be destroyed by the sword. You'll be destroyed. And these whom I have scattered, I will be unto them a sanctuary. I'll be protect them. I'll bring them back and give them the land. Bring it back to them. So where they are come. For a little while in the country where they are come. Therefore say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, I will gather you from the peoples and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And that's the ones who are carried away. That's the ones in Jerusalem will say, we're rid of them. God took them out of the land of ours. God says, no, I'm going to destroy you, and out of these that I've scattered, I'm going to bring back my remnant. So up here, you see, that's an answer to his question. You know, Lord, will you make a full end of the remnant of Israel? No, I'm not going to make a full end of the remnant. I'm going to bring back a remnant. I'll always have my remnant. He still has. And so I'll have it when Jesus comes back. And they shall come thither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof, and all the abomination thereof from thence. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I will take the stony heart out of their flesh, and will give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Now that's talking about, not necessarily talking about the New Testament remnant right here. That's talking about other places, but they're trying to blend into that. But he's talking about the remnant that he's going to bring back from the captivity. And to these he'll give a new heart and a new spirit. In other words, they'll come back with a different spirit, a different attitude, a different disposition. Let me pause there before I move on, and let me turn to the 30th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. Turn with me, if you will, to that chapter. I want to note here what God said here in the first few verses. Now, if you find your place, chapter 30, verses 1 through 7 and 8. Now, this is Moses here, and the people received the land. He made this covenant with them. You notice in verse chapter 29 here, these are the words of the covenant which Jehovah commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel and so on. And he has a second covenant beside that made at Mount Sinai, back earth. This is in Moab. Now this is the covenant here that God's going to make. And it shall come to pass, when all these things, that's the curses of chapter 29 there, 28 rather, I'm talking about the covenant you made now. All these things in chapter 28, that's the curse. When all these things are come to pass, I come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, whither Jehovah thy God had driven thee. Now notice, you're going to call these things to mind now. Well, that's why we are in Ezekiel. We're among these nations where they've been scattered now. Here's what God said, and shalt return unto Jehovah thy God, first and second, and shall obey the voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children, now third, with all thy heart, with all thy soul, that then, I know it, that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity, and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the peoples whither Jehovah thy God hath scattered thee. Now here's some ifs. If any of thine outcasts be in the uttermost parts of the earth, of heaven rather, from thence will Jehovah thy God gather thee, and from thence will he fetch thee, and Jehovah thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it, and he will do thee good, and multiply thee above thy fathers, and that's also said in Ezekiel, we'll come to that later on, and Jehovah thy God will circumcise thy heart, and the heart of thy seed, to love Jehovah thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and thou, that thou mayest live it. Now note, here God promised to do more for them when they come back than he had done for their fathers. But that's conditional. They came back, but they didn't live up to that for which they came back, so God could never do for them. Now this is where the millennialists miss it. They go through and take these promises, conditional promises that God made of what he would do for the children of Israel when he brought them back, and they say, now those promises were not fulfilled. Therefore, God will have to bring the Jews back to Palestine and risk and establish them there in order to fulfill these promises that he made. Not a word of truth in that. The promises of what God would do if you come back and do what I tell you to do, but they didn't do that. The Jews never did. When he came back from Babylon, they rebuilt the temple finally, but they went into this, they never went into idolatry, they never worshipped images after that. But they never served God either, as they should have. So God couldn't do, all those promises were not fulfilled and never will be fulfilled because they were conditional. Conditional wasn't kept. And the first person wants to remember that when he said in the Old Testament. Some of them were, yes. I'm not saying all of them, but God couldn't do what he promised to do. Now notice further. And Jehovah thy God will put all these curses upon thine enemies and on them that hate thee and persecuted thee. Now look at these two verses. And thou shalt return and obey the voice of Jehovah, and do all his commandments as I command you this day. That's what you're to come back to do. Did they do it? No, they didn't do it. And Jehovah thy God will make thee plenteous in all the work of thy hand, in the fruit of thy body, and in the fruit of thy cattle, and in the fruit of thy ground for good. For Jehovah will again rejoice over thee for good, as he rejoiced over thy fathers. I know these two conditional ifs. If thou shalt obey the voice of Jehovah thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, second if thou turn unto Jehovah thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul. For this is the commandment God commands there and so on there. Alright? Now, and the word goes on down to say that, the word is nigh thee in thy heart and so on there. So, God's going to bring them back, and those that came back did come back with a different heart and spirit. But it didn't last. They lapsed right back into the old condition there that you find in Nehemiah and Ezra there, Malachi. Those set forth what you found, what they turned into there. They dealt with in those three books after you come back. All right. Now, another one I want to look at, if I may, is in the 32nd chapter of Jeremiah. What he promised here in this chapter. And, what if my time is up and it didn't work? Well, I'm going to look at it for just a minute anyway. Just a little too long for you. But anyway, he's going to bring them back, and they're going to make an everlasting covenant with them, so I'll have to deal with that later on. My time is up.